You are listening to Counterterrorism After 9/11, a podcast series by the International Center for Counterterrorism, exploring how our field has changed in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. Today, Counterterrorism After 9/11 is speaking to Ambassador Roya Rahmani, Afghan diplomat and the first woman to serve as the Afghan ambassador to both the United States and Indonesia. With nearly two decades of experience working with governments, non-governmental organizations, and multilateral institutions, Ambassador Rahmani will be discussing her experiences as a woman in diplomacy, her critical work promoting women's rights globally, and what the future holds for Afghanistan. Interviewing her is Dr. Joanna Cook, an ICCT Senior Project Manager and Editor-in-Chief of the ICCT Journal.
It is my distinct pleasure today to have the opportunity to speak with Ambassador Roya Rahmani, a former Afghan diplomat with nearly two decades of experience working with government, non-governmental organizations, and multilateral institutions. Ambassador Rahmani was the first woman to serve as the Afghan ambassador to the United States, the first Afghan woman ambassador to Indonesia, and the first to serve as Director General for Regional Cooperation at the Afghan Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Ambassador Rahmani, welcome.
Thank you.
As part of this podcast, we're talking about the different experiences of individuals who have experienced the last 20 years, particularly since 9/11, in very distinct ways. But we're always starting with the point of that day. And where were you on 9/11? What was your position on the day of 9/11? And what do you really recall about that day?
I was a student at McGill University. I vividly recall what happened that day. It was in the morning, and I had just finished a class. I believe it was discrete math, because my degree is in computer science and software engineering from McGill. So I walked out in the hallway, and I just saw the students running up to the screens, and there was this sense of astonishment and shock and the panic. I tried to figure out what was going on, and I learned about the incident. I did not know about the magnitude. I had not seen the footage. So prior to that, of course, I have lived in war. I have been in Afghanistan where, and in the capital, living there, when in a day I have tried to count the number of missiles hitting around us, and I would lose counts, and then I would try to listen to the news to see, and it would be over 2,500 a day. This is during civil wars. So, the reason I'm explaining this is that I did not see what was going on. I had not looked at the footage as of at that moment. And I just heard there's a bombing in New York. And I said, yeah, that's terrible. I mean, it just flashed all the memories of bombings in my head. But then when I saw that sense of panic, and I'm like, okay, yes, it's a bombing, but why people are acting like this? Because I grew up with bombing all around me all the time. So I not realizing the magnitude of it, and I'm like, okay, so what is going on? Why are they acting? But then, of course, I walked out of the campus. I found women, a woman sitting on a bench crying, and I went up to her and I said, have you lost somebody? Did you know someone? And she said, no, it's just so devastating to see what's happening. And all of this entire experience was sort of new to me, because I came from a country where everything had reduced to numbers. How many missiles hit? How many people killed? How many people injured? And you move on, because that's the mode. But then, of course, when I learned about the magnitude and about what happened, and just looked at the footage, of course, it was devastating, and it just brought that real crumb inside me, because it was like, and one of the thoughts that ran in my head is that is that going to spread? Is it going to be all over what I had tried to escape and I thought we had escaped? Is it going to be even haunting us here? So these are this is basically where I was. And of course, much followed after that. But then as things were sinking in me, of course, I thought that, oh, I hope this is also a signal for change for Afghanistan. And I had been on the verge and waiting for a change to happen and for that severe draconian regime that was in place, the Taliban at the time, to be ousted, especially since they blew up the Buddhas. I mean, I had experienced firsthand a lot of different forms of tragedies. But then when that happened, I was again a student in Canada, and I noticed that I came home and I saw these giant, beautiful statues going to air as ashes. That was devastating, and I had kept thinking, how is it going to end? So by learning what happened, I thought, probably it's going to be also signaling a change back for Afghanistan.
And we did see at that time, almost immediately after, an international coalition go into Afghanistan, and we all know the war in Afghanistan subsequently. Being in Canada at that time as a student, you were doing software engineering, this war was starting to happen in Afghanistan. What did all of this mean for your professional path that's led you to your position today?
Well, of course, initially, nobody knew what was going on, right? Like, especially people like myself. I came from a very apolitical family. Nobody ever in my family worked in government. So we were just in a wait-and-see mode, because when the Taliban took over in 96, I was a refugee in Pakistan. And then we did not know necessarily what they are and who they are. We just, when we heard about the takeover, we were happy initially in the very first moment, like, okay, so there's a change, because we were so fed up with the civil war. So, but then it turned out to be devastating. Like the minute that they entered Kabul and they ran and took out the former president and hanged him, we all froze. And like, I was a teenager, like, oh my God, what is this? It's getting from bad to worse. So, When the bombing and everything started with the coalition going in, it was a moment of hope, but at the moment of also confusion. I wasn't sure what's going on, but of course, as the new government was formed and established, and there was this. By then I had graduated from my degree. I was working as an engineer in a tech company, and life was good. But then, looking at what was going on in Afghanistan, I had this continuous itch that I need to contribute. Life is bigger than this. There has been something I have been waiting all along for, and especially for women's rights. So I called my family and I said, they had returned back to Afghanistan at the time. I was alone on my own. And this is how I traveled to Canada to study. And then I said, I want to return. And they said, what do you want to do? I said, women's rights. They said, like, you just finished your degree. You are an engineer. Why not? And like, you don't understand. This is something I have been waiting all along my life. So that was the impact. I returned, and I did return. When there was a possibility for me to return, I gave up my life, like job, apartment, my life basically in 3 days. I didn't have the time to do a proper move or anything. I just asked my friends to wrap it up. And I went back to Afghanistan, initially trying to go for a short period of time, but then that became my life.
And so the work that you were doing subsequently in Afghanistan did initially focus, as I understand, largely on advancing the rights of women and the status of women with non-governmental organizations. And while you were working in these positions, how did the war around you impact on that status of women in Afghanistan and the work you were trying to do to advance the status and position of women in the country?
Initially, when I started in 2004, things were good. Those were like the sort of the best years, I must say. And then the women were very energetic, very vibrant. The capacity was pretty low. The human capital was not developed. We were all very much focused in just reconstructing Afghanistan, and not Afghanistan, but mindsets, the way we did things, the transferring skills, and much more. So my work was basically, I was the head of an organization that funded other women organizations all around the country to work for promotion of women's rights and relevant development projects. So at that time, the war was not bad, but as every year it got worse. And by 2006, 2007, there was an active war going on again all around. The bombing had started again. And of course, I was seeing some of the things, like it took us so much time in 2004 and 2005 to encourage the women to build that stamina and confidence, to shed their burqas, to come out, to seek education, to be able and dare to be publicly visible. That was the focus. And then by war starting again and deterioration of the security situation, that was already rolling back. Because what happens always in the situation of war and conflict, women are affected in way more than men. Because one of the major things that is getting affected is their mobility. Their presence in public sphere reduces tremendously. So they and it happens all the time. And then also for their own protection, As the war and the conflict got worse, they would be worried for their lives. And I remember how one of the very first activist women that was killed during those years was the woman who was in charge of the provincial office of Ministry of Women's Affairs in Kandahar. She was an elderly woman. I had met her. And then the next thing I hear is that the Taliban went and killed her. So it sent a very tragic and also alarming message to a lot of women. So it had already started to impact them. But I must say that still everybody was going full swing because they were trying to make it. And they knew that there is so much ground to cover.
Yeah.
And there's an increasing body of research and evidence today that demonstrates that the status of women and women's rights is directly correlated with national security. But we haven't really yet seen this translated practically to areas such as governance, diplomacy, and indeed security practices. When we look at Afghanistan, what were some of the biggest barriers to advancing that work on women, peace, and security that you saw? And do you think that women, peace, and security agenda, for example, the National Action Plan, was it taken seriously in Afghanistan at the time?
No. The short answer is no, because, what are the barriers? To begin with, in Afghanistan, any government that comes to power, one of the very first things that they signal is their position on women. And it's for a reason. Because it is immensely important of how they define themselves vis-a-vis gender roles. And it has been a continuous battle and the pendulum going from one side to another between modernity and extremism. And of course, as it's moving from one side to another, women usually get crashed in the middle. Why the Women, Peace and Security agenda hasn't been real in Afghanistan, I must say. Number one, there has been a deep-rooted belief and perception of the gender role. Second, it has been always used as an instrument of power, very much so. third, women have never been afforded to have, I wouldn't even say a fair share, I would say any share, any real share in financial, political, or social capital. And in my view, that the basis of the lack of capital is lack of financial capital. Now, in Afghanistan, it's a little bit more difficult because we haven't had a functional economy for so long. And therefore, political or politics is also financial capital, or political capital is also financial capital and much more. But women have not been afforded. The reason that women had so much achievements and progress over the past 20 years is because of the role of the international community and their emphasis. But it could have been done more and better. I do not, so to your question that there is a body of research demonstrating the importance of their role in peace and security, that is neglected. I don't think we have gotten to that, or we ever got to that point in Afghanistan, that concept was accepted, or even there was acceptance or openness to think or debate that. I think it has been just, the perception has been so closed, and therefore this has been happening. But again, I must say that when, for example, I was ambassador to Indonesia, and I have worked in Southeast Asia and some African countries, one of the major differences that I saw is the lack of access for Afghan women to the markets, to the banking system, which of course didn't exist even at the time, and to the financial mechanisms. That was defining their role in the rest of the areas as well. And frankly speaking, I think involvement of women in security sector probably would be one of the things that would come last. And this is... let me say that it is very disappointing that this is not even an issue only in Afghanistan, which is still, which continuously have been marked as one of the worst places to be a woman on the face of earth. But then when you look at the data also shows in terms of the gender gap that to achieve parity in the political realm, it's going to take 147 years. Globally.
And when we look at, you know, even in Afghanistan, there was a lot of effort and time and money sunk into training up the security forces, for example. And we did see the emergence of women in the police forces, for example, in the Afghan National Army to a limited extent. But a lot of this was raised with the idea of not only advancing the equality of women, but also giving women access to those security institutions. Do you believe that there was a mindset related to the roles that some of these women were taking up in those security forces? Was there a more openness or a willingness to see women take up roles within those security forces over these years?
Frankly speaking, the women who joined the security forces, they were some of the bravest women, and it was always very difficult for them and for their families. They were labeled. They were very openly assumed to be immoral women, and even their work environment was extremely discriminatory and abusive. I know of numerous cases of abuse and sexual assault within the security sector towards the female workers. So they were, some of the bravest people. Mind you, I have to also mention one other fact here. When it comes to the collapse of Afghanistan, people say, "Oh, why the security forces did not resist and did not fight and whatnot?" And when they draw the comparison with the Taliban forces, there are many factors, bigger factors. But one of the factors is also that a lot of people who joined the Afghan security forces were people who were seeking employment. They had absolutely no other means of earning a living, and they joined the security forces. So that was defining their purpose and morale also. So for women, there were some that were completely driven by the goal and the morale and what to achieve. But for a lot of them, it was also an economic motive to join the security forces, number one. Number two, that was contributing to mindset. The other fact was that they were extremely underserved. Let me explain to you an anecdote. One of the senators here in the United States, who is a veteran herself, a very prominent and somebody that I respect very much, continuously asked me about a project and what happened to it and why it never got implemented. And it is like over 10 years that they allocated funding for it and it never got implemented. And finally, I told her the truth. So let me tell you a little bit about that. At one point, because of her own experience in her committee, they allocated $20 million to build bathrooms for female forces. It never materialized. Never. And eventually, when we look at it, because the money was earmarked in a way that there couldn't have been corruption, there was no room for corruption. So it never got done. The same way there was a mindset. The mindset was mainly two things. Number one, people at the very local grassroots level looking how women were contributing now to the economy of the family and going in all the fields that encouraged them and this paved the way for the women to join the security sector. The women themselves wanting to do something different and the economic motive to get a job. But then the resistance and obstacles were just like going all against them.
When we look at that initial decision to go into Afghanistan, it was to prevent Afghanistan from being viewed as a safe haven for terrorists again. That was the initial discussion around the invasion. And I wonder when we reflect on that decision, and we look at the time and the money and the effort that's been sunk into countering extremism and countering terrorism in the country over these two decades, what have been some of the biggest lessons learned? So what, if anything, has been done well in those attempts to reduce extremism in the country and to tackle terrorism? And what should have been done differently?
Well, what has gone right? The thing is that when now we are looking at what happened in Afghanistan, everybody is generalizing everything, and of course there is huge disappointment, and a lot of people think that the whole 20 years was a waste and nothing happened, and we didn't achieve anything regarding counterterrorism or counter extremism and whatnot. That's not true. In fact, you did not see any major attack emanating over the past 20 years or the vice from Afghanistan. The second thing is, we know about the incidences that did happen, but we don't know about the incidences that were prevented. And there were massive amount of them. But in terms of counterterrorism and counter-extremism, there is one very specific phenomena. Once I was having a discussion with the people who are experts in the field of counterterrorism in Singapore. And one of the points that was emphasized over was that when the terrorists were interrogated and what came out of it, the general statement was that every terrorist had a broken heart. So there was an element of hopelessness. The past 20 years gave hope to so many people. It played with their mindset and it gave them a shift in their mindset. It built a human capital that we never had. It taught people different ways of living and expectation and aspirations and whatnot. So many, because Afghanistan is such a young country, so many people got educated. All of that played a major role in carving counterterrorism and extremism because in this era of technology and social media, it is very easy to get the younger generation, the youth, attracted to these ideas. And also, if we are living in a place that there is multiplicity of truth, you don't know everybody, somebody can define a new truth and people can subscribe to that, and that is their truth. Or the fact, or sort of ideology. And we keep seeing that. But in Afghanistan, that was really controlled and managed with everything that did happen. So there was much that went right. All the people that got educated and they want to come out, it's an indication that they cannot live under the extreme rules. That's why everybody wants to come out. And of course, their aspiration and everything. So it did work, and it had lots of positive outcome and results. What could have been done different and what could have been better was that the international community did not have a firm enough grip on accountability. What contributed to something which... Well, namely corruption, that fueled extremism. People became radicalized because of the grievances they developed. And a lot of it were emanating from the corruption that was just so prevalent all around the country. And as we went along, it got from bad to worse, to the point that in their very recent years and months, everybody was so extremely fed up with the incumbent government that they didn't want to change, because they knew that it is really just the entire faith and what happens to the country and their security and whatnot is in hand of few people's pleasure.
And when we look at, for example, at how the war was conducted in Afghanistan or how counterterrorism has been conceived of, it's still very Western-centric. And I wonder from your perspective, was the knowledge, was the experience, were the perspectives of Afghans, were they tapped into enough, were they considered enough, were the ideas that there could be different ways of approaching these topics? Do you believe that they were adequately considered, or was there a chance for Afghans to actually shape that agenda or inform it in a way that might have worked better for Afghans?
Yes, I think there was certainly more room to tap into their understanding, their expertise, their knowledge, and their abilities, which was not. Counterterrorism is as much of a hard issue as it is a soft issue. And that aspect of it has, unfortunately, I think, has been undermined continuously. So you are looking at the military aspect looking at the city as a very hard issue is not necessarily yielding fruit in based on the experiences that I have had in dealing with this issue, is that the hard aspect of the CT should be a deterrent factor as well as a supplemental factor, not the factor, the main instrument for countering terrorism. It should be a supplement to that. There should be so many other aspects of it. Like, for example, the issue was also that there was never a clear and consistent policy in terms of whether the coalition really want to engage in nation building or not, or they serious about helping the system of governance and institutionalization or not. It was something in between all of these. Plus, often there were the warlords and the power holders that were continuously supported to build their own militias, and that contributed to the failure of the mission, I would say. So, yes, there was room to tap into the Afghans' abilities to counter terrorism, and there still will be. There still is. It is, and yes, it was not adequately utilized, I would say.
We saw the U.S., for example, take a very swift exit, and currently we're sitting in the Netherlands, and there's the impression that a lot of U.S. partners were. We're perhaps left a bit in the dark. But do you feel that the international partners that were in Afghanistan had taken the steps to adequately prepare for the moment of withdrawal?
If you mean all the countries who went in alliance with the United States to Afghanistan, if you're referring to them as the international community, that's one question. But if you are talking to United States itself, is another question. But the main question is, in fact, that what the international community wanted, did they have a common objective? Did they want to engage in, and in what way? Or was it just a blanket feeling or a statement, or like at the political incentive that we are fatigued and it has been too long, and whatever happens, this is it. We need to leave and move on, because our constituencies, our parliament, our voters are fed up with this issue. There's no more support. So that's a longer and different debate. But I think to answer the question whether they were prepared or not, we need to also first answer what was their objective. And simply, a lot of people were of the view that the international community simply did not care enough to see what happened, to experience what's happening. It is happening. There are conferences being held. There are pledges being made. People get together. They have discussions. It is life as usual. And then, of course, the collateral damage have been always the people of Afghanistan and over the decades.
The people of Afghanistan have certainly been the ones to suffer the most from this war, without question. And when we look at the state of Afghanistan today, we see the Taliban has taken power. Groups like Islamic State and Al-Qaeda remain active in the country. And when we look to the international community, what steps or what actions should the international community take today to continue to support Afghanistan and the people of Afghanistan?
Again, I might have to repeat my question because, and it is not because I'm avoiding talking on behalf of the Afghans, but I, realistically speaking, I would say what action they could take depends on what they want. I could suggest that for example, if I were to suggest that, oh, there should be another intervention, and that might not be even in the cards, that might not be even a possibility for consideration. So depending on what they want. But the thing is, assuming that the international community does not want a refugee crisis. They do not want a humanitarian catastrophe that is like literally happening in Afghanistan. They are concerned about Afghanistan becoming once again a cradle for terrorism. They do not want Afghan women to go to be thrown back to the dark days. Assuming these are all true, then they really need to put their weight into empowering communities, even if they are not going to have a relationship with the current government because of who they are and what they are, but then there are ways. And for that to happen in a way that is meaningful, it should not be just pledging money to the multilateral to deliver wheat and kidney beans and 2 kilos of sugar to each family, but rather engage in more in a better way, like promoting communities and supporting them to have to partner in, for example, digging wells or establishing clinics and then protecting it and then having some sort of ownership. The community building, community empowerment is the way forward. And that would be the best. And the other thing that they need to do is if they want to make a difference, they need to empower women, really. They need to... I usually do not want to use the word empower because I think it's patronizing to begin with, but then involve them. They really need to be engaged in making those decisions because that is for the welfare of the community.
What should that look like vis-a-vis the Taliban?
Well, this is why I don't know if I mentioned that for something like that to happen in a meaningful way, you need to be really creative, try new approaches, do things differently. You have to let go some of the bureaucratic processes and engage people, engage Afghans. There is the human capital that you built over the past 20 years is something that is one of your best instruments, and they are your eyes, and they can help basically devise those kind of programs and projects in a way that it would be meaningful.
Do you see the Taliban being open to taking a role or engaging with the international community to advance some of these considerations?
Yes, they would, because I think the Taliban leadership understands that they don't have full capacity of governing except when it comes to ideology. Second, they of course, anyone would realize that a starving nation is not in their best interest. They might be, but they, let's be realistic. Who the Taliban are? They were an insurgent group that they have only fought all the time for a very particular ideology with a very specific moral. Now, with the takeover that they had, now they are faced with a whole range of issues. They had one thing, one specific objective, and they were able to carry it out. And be disciplined. But now there is 1,000 different things to take care of with that requires technical capacity, which they lack. Plus, for them to continue to be a solid group, to ensure that all their faction and segments are unified, they need to hold on to what they have been preaching, meaning it's not easy for the Taliban to go tomorrow and tell their fighters that, well, listen, we told you for the past 20 years that you should women's places at home and it would be sinful if they are not, and then you would be punished in and you will go to hell. And now let's think differently, because it is better for our governance. And because a lot of these young fighters, they just grew up with that fuel, with that ideology. So they have also challenges of altering that. If assuming at the best case scenario that some of them would be open to that, which from my experience, it is not necessarily true, because many of them, they are very much the same people that they were 20 years ago.
You've answered all the questions that I really wanted to pose to you today, and I'll turn it over to you. If there's anything else that we haven't discussed today that you think is important to raise, or a final statement you'd like to make, I'll turn it over to you.
One of the things that I keep saying I repeat as an answer when people ask me what is going to happen to Afghanistan moving forward, and my response is that what happens to the women of Afghanistan will define what happens to Afghanistan. And it is not just a cliche. It's not just because of my personal and professional experience and connection to the issue, but it is something that would really define the future of the country. So I think one of the biggest and best achievements or most tangible achievements of the past 20 years have been the progress that women made in Afghanistan. And I believe that the international community can make good use of that.
Ambassador Rahmani, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Counterterrorism After 9/11, a new podcast series from the International Center for Counterterrorism. For more insight, find us at icct.nl. Stay tuned for more episodes of Counterterrorism After 9/11.